How many of you knew that secondary school was hardly the only path to maturity until World War II? Junior high school didn't even exist until well into the 20th century. And high school was only a minor part of society until the second quarter of the same century. Now, maybe you think that's progress, but how do you factor this little detail in? Did you know that even today, in wealthy Switzerland, less than one kid in four goes beyond elementary school? Shall I repeat that? In the richest nation in the world per capita, less than one kid in four goes beyond elementary school. You wouldn't be likely to know that because North America's responsible newspapers, magazines, and media outlets and education schools don't bother to tell you that. And that's a big paradox, wouldn't you agree? For most of our history, kids did not go to secondary school, at least most kids didn't, yet the unschooled rose to be admirals like Farragut, inventors like Edison, captains of industry like Carnegie and Rockefeller, presidents like Washington and Lincoln, writers like Melville, or scholars like Margaret Mead, who never saw the inside of a schoolroom. People who reached age 13 were not looked upon as children. Ariel Durant, who co-wrote the well-known History of the World, sold by Book of the Month Club, which I guess some of you own because they use it as a premium, was married at 13 to the man she stayed married to for more than 50 years. Would she really have been better off doing junior high school homework than starting her life? Was her husband, Will Durant, some form of sexual pervert? Or is there something left out of the story that we've been sold about the proper role of 13-year-olds? If we had a successful system of education before we had universal forced schooling, as the examples of Lincoln, Carnegie, and Margaret Mead suggest, why were these training grounds in boredom that we call forced schooling demanded as a replacement for it? It's a puzzle. But as we track childlike, childish, and boring schools to their origins, we find ourselves back in time about two centuries in the northern European nation of Prussia. By 1820, Prussia was teaching the world that schools could be training grounds for obedient political subjects. I'll just step away from the script for a minute to say that the three traditional purposes of schooling, wherever it's appeared around the world, still seem reasonable to most people if you present them with the case. The first purpose we could call the religious purpose, to make good people, but in fact there are systems to approach that in the secular world as well. The second purpose is to make good citizens, people that will shoulder the burden of the community, act as leaders, take on responsibility for other people. And the third purpose is that your individual God-given gifts can be developed, can be enhanced in this protected environment. Purpose one, purpose two, purpose three. Nothing about creating obedient political subjects, which is the fourth purpose of schooling, and that's the subject of the film I'm trying to make about the history of schooling. It's called The Fourth Purpose, and if any of you have a yen to get on my website, it's just my name with .com at the end of it, and you can read about that film. Anyway, Prussia was teaching the world that schools could be training grounds to be obedient political subjects, and that the mechanism to perform this magic was, not surprisingly, habit training, sensitizing children to be reflexively responsible to propaganda. How well this scheme worked to concentrate state power in that little poor nation up against the North Sea, the world was soon to learn in three titanic Prussian wars between 1871 and 1945. I say Prussian wars because Prussia eventually swallowed all of Germany. Beyond its war-enhancing ability, Prussian habit control schools served the emerging mass production business empires just coming into being as dominant factors in national economies. German psychology early saw that the school could condition children to be susceptible to any sort of authoritarian appeals, including the soft-core authoritarianisms of advertising and public relations. If that were true, then Adam Smith's implacable laws of supply and demand could be repudiated. For if demand could be created for anything or any idea, a managerial revolution was at hand, one which freed managers, including politicians who are, after all, social managers, freed them from a slavish inquiry and dependence upon public opinion. Public opinion could be what management made it. And for any of you here who are students of business, of marketing, you know that marketing really means overcoming sales resistance. This can be done by saying, hey, you've got a flat tire and I'll sell you a good tire to replace it, but can also be done by saying that set of apparently good tires you have in your car is horrible and it's socially degrading and you can buy these tires that have a white stripe around the wheel and upgrade your social status. Now, if you think that's an absurd story about tires, I want you to think about sneakers for children that cost $150, even though they're made of exactly the same materials in the same factories as the sneakers that are made for $10 for children. And the only difference is the Air Jordan logo on the side and maybe a slight difference in styling. So this is a major idea I'm presenting to you, and it was a major idea when it occurred to businessmen, big businessmen, not merchants, big businessmen, that they didn't have to wait for a demand, that they could take whatever supply was easily at hand or cheapest at hand and peddle it by psychological means. Thus, from the very beginning, the founders of compulsory schooling aimed at collectivizing and socializing the ordinary population through the inculcation of habits of dependency. In simpler terms, they worked to extend childhood beyond its natural limits by arranging the removal of young people from home and neighborhood surroundings and their placement with total strangers. False kin, as it were, unknown to parents. And to deepen the bewildering estrangement, these strangers were themselves under the comprehensive direction of faraway strangers, completely hidden from public view, from whose decisions there was no appeal. I hope that the Latinate phrasing doesn't conceal from you that I'm talking about the fact that your local principal takes his orders, he thinks, from the local superintendent, but the local superintendent full well knows that he's taking his orders from somewhere else. He's not quite sure where. It might be the Carnegie Foundation. It might be from the government or from its agency assigned to schooling. And if you go into the government and the agencies assigned to schooling, you find out that they're taking their orders from somewhere else, and they're not quite sure where, but they do know that key politicians will punish them if these orders aren't followed. And so we get into the rarefied realm of political control, but that will save for another talk.